Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, May 18th. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. We'll check in with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times and Jim Kinsella from the Enterprise newspapers. And now a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the Islands. Patrick, more details came out this week about what happened in the Marston's Mills house where Sergeant Sean Gannon was killed last month, including some information about voicemail and text messages. This information came out after the Cape Cod Times filed a motion to lift the impoundment on the court documents.
Yeah, as you say, these documents were impounded on the day of the arraignment of the defendant, in this case, Thomas Latanowicz, who is accused of shooting and killing Sergeant Sean Gannon and shooting his canine dog, Nero, during a search warrant or an arrest warrant that they were pursuing Latanowicz on at this house at 109 Blueberry Lane in Marston's Mills the day before. The impoundment occurred. And obviously, these records in the police report contain some additional details. We pursued those in normal course of events. These details are often available sooner. The DA's office argued that they needed to keep them from the public for at least the time being for various reasons. And we had, I think, filed last week. They released some additional information last week in the form of a press release, and there were some details in there that actually weren't even in the police report that came out 2 days ago. But again, during this hearing, the judge decided to lift this impoundment order. And within those documents, it really lays out a little bit more of a timeline. And obviously, there are a lot of questions that continue to be asked about what happened, you know, from the standpoint of how Thomas Latanowicz, who was again accused in this case, was out on the streets. That's one aspect of it, but also the day of and what happened in the leading up to the shooting. This lays out a timeline, starts with police arriving about 2:23 at the home, and includes the Massachusetts State Police Violent Fugitive Apprehension Squad, which was information that wasn't reported previously. Yarmouth and Barnstable Police Departments, obviously Sergeant Gannon. They went into the home. They searched the attic. They had heard noise in the attic. They went back up into the attic a second time after finding nothing during the first search. And it was during that second search that Sergeant Gannon was shot. He was pronounced dead at 4:05 at Cape Cod Hospital. But at about 3:40, there were these texts from Latanowicz that were provided through a cell phone. I think his ex-girlfriend he had been communicating with. And he had told her, essentially, that he had shot a police officer, that he had shot a canine. And in these series of texts, pretty distinctly laid out the fact that he was saying, I had done this. And so that's going to be important evidence, obviously, in the case against him. Mm-hmm. But interestingly enough, she was also brought to the scene to try and help talk him out of the house. And eventually he did come out at about 5:30. So again, it gives you a little bit more of the timeline of how things occurred on that particular day. Obviously, these are public records and important, you know, for the public to know, to vet kind of how this process goes forward. And certainly it's the normal course of events that these types of records would be available to the public.
Mm-hmm. Your reporter, Jeff Spillane, spoke with Sergeant Gannon's mother earlier in the week. It's a nice profile of her as she remembers her son.
Yeah, this is somebody who's really taken a leading voice, obviously, as a family member, as his mother, in the aftermath of her son's death, Denise Morency Gannon. The family's from New Bedford. They have a strong Catholic background, and she spoke about some of her beliefs and what she believed her son would think. She also spoke about him as a young a boy and how he was. He was somebody who loved animals. He was a talented artist, and it was really, you know, very touching, obviously, to hear a mother speak about her son. But she's also somebody who's really, you know, taken a role in talking about, you know, needed changes in the justice system, And in gun control laws, she's already been speaking about the need to look at gun control laws and really see if there's ways to make them more stringent so that, you know, certainly people like the man accused of killing her son don't have access to these weapons. So again, Jeff spent quite a bit of time with her and spoke to her about kind of their lives growing up. One of the more touching quotes was he and she would walk together quite a bit while his brother and sister were taking piano lessons. They would go to New Bedford's Buttonwood Park, which is a zoo. And again, he liked animals, so this was some place where he liked to be. And they would have this one-on-one time where they'd walk together. And she basically said at one point to him, you know, I understand that you may not have time for this or you may not want to continue to do this. And he said to her, and this is a quote from her, "Mom, I'll always walk with you." Mm. And she said that stuck with her and has gotten her through what's obviously a very difficult time here. But she, again, is also taking on this role. One of the other interesting things she said in the aftermath of his death, a lot of people were calling for the death penalty for his accused killer. And she said, you know, she didn't believe that. She didn't believe in an eye for an eye or taking a life for a life. And she said she thought he would agree with that, too. Again, this deeply religious background seems to kind of flow through everything she's been saying and through their lives. So an interesting juxtaposition from some of the obviously very emotional response to Sergeant Gannon's death. And again, people are, you know, rightfully upset, but it's, I guess, important, we would think, to hear from the family and certainly his mother and her thoughts on these ideas as well.
The family received some 10,000 letters in the aftermath after Gannon was killed, letters from around the country, people writing with their support. Quite impressive.
Yeah. And she said, you know, what they've experienced is a nation behind them. And again, mm-hmm. that support and that outflowing of support, you get the feeling really was important for the family and certainly continues to be the case. There's, you know, events and there's a memorial planned. There's a park in New Bedford that the school committee recently named in his honor. And again, this is going to continue certainly for years to come. You know, it's not something that people will let be forgotten, it sounds like.
Patrick, in Mashpee, an email from the school superintendent has raised questions about possible ethics violations. Explain what happened here.
Yeah, campaigns are always a tricky time, certainly for town officials. But one thing that's important for them to remember is that when you're communicating about a political campaign, you're not supposed to be using public resources, emails that are public emails, you know, your work email when you work for a town or a school committee. In this case, Mashpee Public Schools Superintendent Patricia Dubois emailed, she actually took a social media post that had been posted by a school committee member and emailed it out to family and students' families and people who she said she wanted to get out to vote. But within that social media post, there was essentially an endorsement of the two incumbents who were running for school committee. That's George Schmidt and Jeffrey Gorman. And in doing that, in forwarding that email along through her work account, Dubois may have run afoul of the Office of Campaign and Political Finance rules that say she shouldn't be doing that. You could see this email was, you know, topped with "you get out the vote," and you could see that mistake being made if she hadn't read thoroughly through the email. But in addition to that, Schmidt had also sent an email to somebody in town using his school committee email, which is, again, a public resource, and using his school committee email saying, "Hey, there's a big campaign. There are people, two write-in candidates who are vying for these positions, and we really need to get people out to vote for me," essentially. And in doing that, he also seems to potentially have run afoul of these campaign ethics rules. Dubois says she didn't intend for it to be an endorsement. She was forwarding it as a way of, again, getting out the vote, but it did raise questions. The email that Schmidt had sent had gone to a town employee who had then touched base with the town manager. It was not forwarded along as he had asked to a task force of some sort in the town, and so it kind of ended there. But his mm-hmm. action of sending that out through his work email or his school committee email, again, doesn't seem to line up with how the rules require town officials or school officials to act.
Let's speak right now with Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Sarah, Steamship Authority Board met on the island this week and voted to pursue an outside review of its operations. This was a lively meeting, it sounded like.
Definitely. And I've covered several Steamship Authority Board of Governors meetings here on the Vineyard and in other places, and I can safely say I've never seen a turnout like this. More than 200 people turned out at the Performing Arts Center at the high school here on Tuesday for this meeting on the Vineyard, and Vineyarders, after all, had pressed for this meeting to take place here on the island because of the recent ferry breakdowns and cancellations and really building frustration among island residents about, you know, whether the ferry service is reliable and wanting to have the Steamship Authority take some action. So the meeting was about 2 hours, lots of public comment, mostly devoted to public comment, you know, with long lines at the microphones and many elected officials attending, selectmen from island towns. And as you said, you know, the upshot of the meeting was that the Board of Governors, which is, you know, the five members representing the port towns, voted unanimously to seek a complete independent review of Steamship Authority operations. So they are going to seek proposals from consultants to review things, you know, from management structure, fleet maintenance, internet, communications. So they're going to seek proposals from companies, and they're going to be reviewed, and they hope to have a recommendation of which way to go, choosing a consultant to go with by the next board meeting, which is scheduled for June. So they pretty readily agreed to it this time. The issue or the idea of an independent review did come up at the meeting last month, also on the Vineyard. At that time, you know, they said, we think we can handle this internally, and the Vineyard governor, Mark Hanover, was pushing for this then, and it got voted down. But this time, there was, you know, they said this is the right way to go. And, you know, Steamship Authority General Manager Bob Davis apologized for the recent problems again, and board members said, you know, beyond the Vineyard governor who's been calling for this, board members said they take this seriously and they understand the issue, which is that the islanders have lost confidence in the reliability of the boat line, and they need to take some action to restore that faith in the lifeline to the mainland for islanders.
And it's not usual for the Board of Governors to meet at the Performing Arts Center, so they had a sense that this was coming, this big outpouring of public wanting to speak to these issues.
I think so. I think it was definitely there was a real push on the island to hold the meeting here on the Vineyard, and really, you know, after there's a spate of breakdowns in March, and people were certainly worried, but it seemed at that point, at least, that people saw this as maybe an unusual confluence of events, or, you know, this was a fluke. When we had the additional breakdown of Martha's Vineyard this month, and also this report that came out with the really high number of cancellations so far this year.
More than 500.
Like I said, frustration.
More than 500 mechanical breakdowns so far this year. Cancellations due to mechanical breakdowns.
Yeah, compared to, I think the number for all of last year was 26. So, yeah, really high numbers. And, you know, and also it's been pretty clear not only that this is weighing on people's minds, but also that they supported an outside review. People are calling for it. The two boards of selectmen here have sent letters supporting that idea. The Gazette issued a survey last week, and we had about 2,000 responses split between year-round residents and part-time islanders, and 65% of the people said they wanted an independent audit, 77% of year-round residents. And the survey, you know, and all the results are online, but it did indicate widespread dissatisfaction with everything from internet service on the ferry to the website. So certainly it was clear that there was there was a lot of public concern, and you could see it at the meeting, certainly, which was almost entirely public comment, as I said. So we'll see now, I guess, which route they take as far as conducting this independent audit.
Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. Sarah, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. We're going to break now, and when we come back, we'll hear from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point, and we are discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. And on the phone with us right now is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, first, give us an update on Chatham Town election, which happened yesterday.
Sure. There were the highlight of the ballot really was two races for the Board of Selectmen. And incumbents Dean Nicastro and Corey Metters won re-election to another three-year term each. They defeated challenger and former selectman Seth Taylor. And there was also a race to fill a one-year vacancy that was created when Amanda Love resigned earlier this year. And Planning Board Chairman Peter Kukulis won that contest over Shellfish Advisory Committee Chairman Jamie Bassett. You know, for a kind of rainy day, they had a pretty good turnout, about 28%. And the new board met this morning and elected Nicastro as their new chairman.
You have a story, Tim, about Chatham fishermen seeking some dredging along North Inlet. Explain for us what this is about.
Sure. Now, again, we're looking. This is kind of a fallout from this winter storm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's been quite a lot of that this year, and basically Chatham Harbor, the sand in Chatham Harbor was really shuffled around a lot by those storms, and so much so that what was previously the main inlet to the harbor across from Lighthouse Beach is now barely usable, and it's so shallow that fishermen and even the Coast Guard say that really it's only safely traversable at high tide. And both fishermen and the Coast Guard now are primarily using what's referred to, as you said, as the North Inlet, which was created in 2007 to cross from Minister's Point. The problem is that there's a point just south of that inlet around the tip of North Beach Island where the shoaling has created kind of a choke point. And fishermen say that that makes it kind of difficult to get through there at certain tides. And they are asking the town if the town will dredge that area so that they'll be able to get to and from the fish pier more easily. And they like it done sooner rather than later. They're hoping they can get it done this summer for the summer. But while funding doesn't seem to be a challenge, and it seems that the Barnstable County dredge may be available to do it, there are other issues like permitting and dredge disposal, which could get in the way of getting sort of an emergency dredging of this spot. Now, while the inlet itself is within a dredging permit that the town has for that section of the harbor, The inlet is widened so much that channel that the fishermen want to get dredged is actually outside of the permitted area, which means that the town officials say they're going to have to go to approach the state and see if they can get some kind of either exemption or a widening of the permit area to include that. The other problem is what to do with the sand. The ideal place to put it is on North Beach Island, but that's within the boundary of the National Seashore, and the town would have to seek permission from the seashore to do that. And there's another sort of issue with machinery. They need machinery out on the island to move a pipe around to spread out the sand. How to get the machinery out there is a logistical issue as well. So town officials are exploring these things right now. They're hoping that they can get some answers and to see if they can get the dredging done as soon as possible. The other issue that Harbor Master Stuart Smith brought up is that while the work should ideally be done by July 1st in order to sort of get the biggest bang for the buck, because the sand moves around in the harbor, as we've seen, so much that dredging this area may only last a few weeks or a few months. So there's still a number of issues to be hammered out, but fishermen say that it's a priority for them, and town officials agree, and they're going to be working towards a solution.
Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
Patrick Cassidy at the Cape Cod Times. Elections this week for many towns. We heard about Chatham's town election there from Tim, but Orleans, Falmouth, Mashpee, and others. Can you touch on some of the highlights for us of what happened?
Sure. We'll start with Orleans. They approved at the Orleans town election about $4 million for planning, engineering, other work having to do with the town's sewer plans. This is kind of just a down payment on a $58 million plan that they're hoping to get in place between 2020 and 2024. One of the more interesting things that Orleans also did at that election was they agreed to permanently fund $450,000 a year to cover the town's liability for future town retiree insurance and other post-employment benefits, OPEB for anybody who cares about acronyms. But it's important, and it's important because all the towns are facing this kind of train coming down the track of these unfunded liabilities of these benefits that have accrued over the years. And so it seems like Orleans is taking a pretty proactive approach to that. They're doing something similar with a new affordable housing trust fund. An old fund had dissolved, and so they're putting money into a new trust fund. That happened at town election as well. A lot of the towns, like Orleans, approved debt exclusion or money for the new Cape Tech School in Harwich, Cape Cod Regional Technical High School. That's a $128 million project shared by 12 towns where they're going to build the new tech school out there. And the towns had all approved this at kind of a special town meeting earlier in the year, and this is just how they pay for it. They've got to figure it out one way or the other. A lot of them went with these debt exclusions. Moving on to Falmouth, it was a day of incumbents in Falmouth. Most of the incumbents for selectmen, I think all the incumbents for selectmen and other boards won out. Falmouth also had the highest turnout of any town, with almost 30% of voters coming out. And it seems like they were driven in large part by this ongoing debate, you know, decade or more about a new field for the high school, and this debate over artificial turf versus grass. It's been going on for several months. They approved the new artificial turf field at town meeting, and then there was this, you know, more intense campaign leading up to the town election. And at town election, they did approve the new artificial turf field. It's a $3 million project. It includes some other kind of a sundry items, fencing, lights, bleachers, etc. But the artificial turf was the big thing, with some people saying they were worried about the health of athletes who were using it, and other people say it would be more durable over the years and wasn't something where you had to be concerned about. Kind of it's a concern about this particle that's within the turf itself and whether that gets into the bodies of the athletes who are using it. So the town came out, and I think by about 500 or so votes approved that project, so that will go forward. Yarmouth, always a place where there's a lot of school budget discussions. Dennis and Yarmouth share a regional school district. Dennis, it's always pretty straightforward. They approve their funding. They don't have to go to an override. In Yarmouth, it seems like every year they have to look at an override to approve their portion, and that's becoming even more problematic. They're actually gaining students in Yarmouth or putting more students into the school system, and Dennis, I think, is dropping off a little bit. And as you're paying for those more students on Yarmouth's side, the cost is going up for them. They've been working at trying to, you know, in their minds, make it more equitable. Dennis says it is equitable. It's a formula. That's how it works. And interestingly enough, in the Wayback Machine, Yarmouth had decided to go with this formula, or had asked to go with this formula a long time ago, but now they're kind of paying the price. But they did, in the end, approve this Proposition 2.5 override of about $500,000, I believe. Mm-hmm. And that's a big deal, because if they didn't approve that, they would have had to either look for the cuts elsewhere, or eventually in what's called the big tent, where both towns get together and do that. Interestingly enough, turnout was not super high. It was 13% in Yarmouth, so there, you know, some big spending there. And the schools, which usually draw a lot of consternation in terms of that debate, didn't draw a crowd. Two incumbents for selectmen won out in Yarmouth as well, Eric Tolley and Norman Holcomb.
Patrick, let me ask you to pause there. We can pick up on more election stuff just ahead. We have Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror on the line right now. Josh, good morning.
Good morning.
Josh, discovery of Native American remains appears to be on the rise on the island. Explain what this is about.
It is. For about 10,000 years before the first white settlers even stepped onto the island, Native Americans had been on Nantucket, and they estimate that around the mid-1600s when the first Europeans did show. There were about 1,500 members of the Wampanoag tribe here. So there are remains all over the island. And as development has increased again with the latest building boom, and it's happening in places that had previously been undisturbed, some of those remains are being discovered. The most recent occurred about a month or two ago when a foundation was being excavated on a piece of property when a skull was exposed during that excavation and determined to be Native American remains. The Nantucket Police Department, which is the first point of contact, or supposed to be the first point of contact when remains of any kind are discovered, is saying that for the last decade or so, they usually got maybe one or two reports of Native American remains, bones being discovered on the island a year, and last few months, last year or two, it's been upwards of half a dozen or so. So they are showing up, and they kind of bring construction to a halt.
Mm-hmm.
There is a lot of of debate and a lot of discussion around how they are supposed to be treated. The determination is first made, and then if they can be left undisturbed, they're left undisturbed. If they can't, they are taken in a formal process by state archaeologists and Native American community and reburied elsewhere.
I want to ask you about a story from last week, actually, but we didn't speak to you last Friday, about the Cold War-era bunker on the island. It was built for JFK, and it may be open to the public soon.
It might. At the height of Cold War tensions, just after JFK was elected, Nantucket had a small Navy base out here in Tom Nevers, and they built a bunker, a 1,900-square-foot bunker here, to protect the president in the event of nuclear war. They felt that a small Navy installation on an island 30 miles out to sea would be safer and less likely to be the subject of a direct nuclear attack than, say, Boston or perhaps Otis Air Base, where he might otherwise have gone. And it was in service for that for about a year and a half until he was assassinated. And then remained on the Navy property until the Navy base was decommissioned, and it's now just a big bump in the ground, basically, in the middle of the Tom Nevers Fairgrounds, which is a town-owned property. And while revitalization plans for that property were going on, some of the organizers of that initiative discovered that there was a similar bunker in Palm Beach, Florida, that had been a museum, and it was no longer a museum. The owner of that museum had lost their lease, and they got in contact, and this gentleman down in Florida said he'd be more than happy to perhaps donate or give the contents of that bunker and help set it up out here on Nantucket, turn the Nantucket bunker into a museum. Right now, it basically is serving as storage for the Nantucket Island Fair. It had been leased to the Nantucket Hunting Association for about a decade for use as a clubhouse. They did some work in there. So it's been partially renovated. There's not too much left from the Navy era there now, but it could be returned to its 1960s Cold War era look with furniture, with artifacts, similar to what it might have looked like when it was waiting potentially for the president to be ushered there in the event of a nuclear war.
Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you.
We're going to go over to Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Morning, Steve.
Ed, the new Cape Cod National Seashore Superintendent has been speaking out about the advisory commission. He says he's confident there will be a meeting here, even though we haven't heard anything about a date yet. Fill us in here.
Yes, well, we have a new seashore superintendent, Brian Carlstrom, who arrived last month and replacing the former superintendent, George Price, who retired a year ago, actually, now. And it's I'm not sure I'd say that Carlstrom is speaking out about the Seashore Advisory Commission, but at a ribbon-cutting ceremony last week at the Province Lands Visitor Center here in Provincetown, he was asked by our reporter what he was doing to move along the process of scheduling a meeting of this commission, which is a matter of intense local concern. As we've talked about before, I think, on this show, the Advisory Commission was established in 1961 when the National Seashore was created by Congress as a board with representatives from all six towns that have land in the park to advise the superintendent and the Secretary of the Interior on matters that relate to the park and that are of local concern. And for over 50 years now, the commission has met regularly, usually six times a year, and has played a critical role in making the towns really part of the process for deciding what happens in the seashore, which has a profound effect on all of our towns out here. So much of our land is in the seashore. And soon after, about 2 weeks after Ryan Zinke was confirmed as the Secretary of Interior last year, an order went out that all such advisory commissions for national parks would have their meetings suspended until further notice. And so the commission has not met now for 14 months. And in spite of the fact that there have been sort of false alarms along the way, at one point Congressman William Keating said that he had been told that things were cleared and that there was going to be a meeting. In fact, nothing happened. And the members of the commission have grown increasingly concerned that the commission may, in fact, not have another meeting while this current Trump administration is in power.
Now, they have been told they can meet, right, Ed? And so it's a matter of when this happens. Is that right?
Well, here's the way it works. they have been told that there will be a meeting. They have officially requested that a meeting be scheduled for June 18th, but they're not allowed to actually have the meeting unless it is first advertised in the Federal Register, and that advertisement has to appear at least 2 weeks before the date of the meeting. And in the past, what's happened is that if the notice never appeared, and so the meetings couldn't take place. And so far, at least, the notice has not yet appeared. I just spoke yesterday to Richard Delaney, who is the chairman of the Advisory Commission and also head of the Center for Coastal Studies here in Provincetown. And he said, I'm still holding my breath. So there's it needs to be 2 weeks before the meeting, which means June 4th. If that notice doesn't get published by June 4th, then the June 18th meeting will not happen. So we're all waiting with bated breath.
Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Steve.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Patrick Cassidy. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on the Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. And on the phone with us right now is George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve. And good morning, Patrick.
George, you had plenty of coverage of the Steamship Authority meeting this week. I saw you were there live tweeting it. But there's other news on the island, too. And just yesterday, word out that an assistant district attorney is facing a suspension for a month after finding that she abused her prosecutorial power. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is Laura Marshard. And listeners might remember that about a year ago, she went before the Board of Bar Overseers hearing panel. And it was quite a lengthy process. She was before that panel on 8 days, and it lasted over a couple of months. It wasn't consecutive days. Quite a bit of testimony back and forth. Ultimately, that panel decided that she deserved a public reprimand for her conduct in a case here on the island. Interestingly, she typically would have only received an admonishment, and now it's escalated to the point where the full board of bar overseers has looked at this and all the evidence that was brought up during that hearing, and they're not going along with just a public reprimand. They're saying she needs to be suspended for a month and that she needs to go to an ethics course. Quite a development in this. We did hear from Marshard's attorney yesterday. This is Liz Mulvey, who represented her before that hearing. And she is saying that Marshard is going to go ahead and, accept the punishment and that, she believed that she was doing the right thing, but she respects and accepts the board's decision. I want to give a little bit of background, if I could, about what happened here. She was prosecuting a case, and one of the witnesses may have also faced charges, but hadn't been charged yet. She met with him. His name was David Sylvia. She met with him behind closed doors without his attorney present. He had been given a court-appointed attorney just that day, because he did possibly have some incriminating evidence against himself, and so the judge wanted him to be represented, appointed an attorney. But she called on some Edgartown police officers to have Sylvia come in and talk to her. She did that without counsel present, which is what the mistake was on her part. And so there were two other counts that were brought against her. The board found that there wasn't enough evidence to proceed on those counts, but they did. It's really a strongly worded decision on their part, talking about how troubled they are about her misleading a judge. They use the word lies. Mm-hmm. They use the word that she abused her power. And even within that, there is also some admonishment of the district attorney's office itself, saying that that this is a practice that they've employed in other cases, and the board is troubled by that as well. Interestingly, we reached out to Michael O'Keefe, the district attorney, yesterday, and he hasn't returned that phone call or email messages to his office. So we haven't heard from him yet about what the office might do with this case.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, I know we were talking elections. I want to move on, so I want to encourage people who want to get updates on the elections this week to go to your website. You guys had very thorough election coverage from across the region. Let me ask you now about a project in Falmouth. Falmouth's looking to create more affordable housing. They're planning single-bedroom units.
Yeah, this is what's known as workforce housing. This is the Falmouth Housing Corporation looking to add 20 of those to a property on Gifford Street. It's actually been a location where there's currently a garden that's used by the Falmouth Service Center. But they say this is a pretty high priority, and it's going to come in a couple of phases. They're going to get, I think, 10 of them in place and then go from there and add the rest of them. They say, again, this type of housing, it's a little unusual to have kind of these single unit housing in place, but they say it's important to meet the demand for folks who need an affordable. And affordable is relative here on Cape Cod. They say their rents would be $800 to about $1,150, depending on the applicant's income. All utilities are included in that. But again, it's something they're getting grant funding for, and they're moving forward with there in Falmouth.
Jim Kinsella is joining us from the Enterprise Newspapers. Good morning, Jim.
Morning, Stephen.
Jim, you have a story out this morning about an annual tradition in Sandwich that appears to be going away.
That's right, Stephen. This is First Night Sandwich, a much-beloved event. It's been going on since 2012 in Sandwich. And the committee that organizes this, works, puts it together every year. They're just very tired. One organizer talked about being the committee is exhausted. And they're also wondering if the event has run its course. So earlier this week, the committee got together and said, we're going to shut it down. We're going to shelve it. They're going to take a rest for at least a year, but this might be a permanent departure for First Night Sandwich. Now, it's if anyone's been there, it's quite remarkable. They've got a revelers parade. By the way, this is all occurring on
New Year's Eve,
right? So, in sort of the run up to the midnight, they've got a revelers parade of giant puppets. These display of these giant glass sculptures. Twinkling lights throughout the village, musical performances, They do it regardless of the weather. They had some very cold weather this past, most recent one, and still went off, still had a lot of people. So, but anyway, they have put out calls over the years, in recent years, saying, trying to attract new volunteers, people wanting to say, okay, we've done it for a while, let's have some other people come in and do this. It's not the Chamber of Commerce. It's not a big organization. It's a relatively small group.
Mm-hmm.
And but they're not getting takers, so they voted this week to shut it down.
I was surprised to learn in this article, and many folks may be surprised, that it's a volunteer group that puts together this big event in Sandwich each year, not the town or the Chamber of Commerce.
Yep, that's absolutely so. Now, they have offered, one of the organizers, in fact, has put together what she calls a playbook of organizational details, so kind of a guide to putting on First Night Sandwich. So in case some people want to step forward and say, gosh, we'd really like to keep this tradition going, they're happy to help them, mentor them, but someone else would have to step in. And if they don't, and if it doesn't happen quickly, because it takes a while to put this on, organize it as the event approaches, it's simply not going to happen this December.
Jim Kinsella from the Enterprise Newspapers. Jim, thanks for coming in this morning.
You're welcome, Steve.
Patrick Cassidy, in elementary school is closed today after what seems to have been a norovirus sent home a big number of students and staff.
Yeah, for us, this started with a phone call we received yesterday from somebody who said that, you know, a lot of students at Centerville Elementary School had been sickened, and staff as well. We checked in with school officials, and they confirmed that, and we were able to get a message that the principal had sent out to parents yesterday afternoon, confirming that they had contacted the Department of Public Health, and they believe that it's the norovirus that sickened these students. More than 100 students and staff had become ill, and they started being sent home on Wednesday, really. I think about 50 students were absent on Wednesday, and 20 more had to be dismissed. So not a small number of students in a school that serves about 262 students. It's a K-3 school. But again, there were a lot of staff involved as well. A third of the staff there were sickened. And so the school said, we're not opening school today, Friday here. We're going to shut down. We're going to clean the school. They're doing, you know, a quote-unquote deep cleaning, kind of interesting cleaning process where they take a tool that creates an electrostatic mist with antibacterial solution that clings to everything. But for a lot of people, this idea of these germs that could be carrying the norovirus, which can really hit you for a loop. It's only about 3 days that you're sick for, but from everything I've heard, I haven't ever had it myself, but from everything I heard, it's 3 days that you would not wish upon anyone. So they have the school closed today. They say they hope to have it open again on Monday, but they just decided the better part of valor here was to just send everybody home and close up and clean up, and they're going to continue to clean it throughout the weekend. The day lost today will be made up at the end of the school year on June 22nd, according to the principal.
Another story out today, the number of trees cut down along the roadway in Barnstable Village has some folks upset. This is along Route 6A.
And anybody who knows Route 6A and certainly Barnstable Village knows that it's an area that's not, you know, too amenable to change. It's the old King's Highway that runs through, I think, about six towns on the north side of the Cape. Barnstable kind of being the heart there with the Barnstable County Court Complex, the old jail. There's all sorts of history there. Mm-hmm. And some of these trees have probably been around for a lot of that history. These are large trees. They're all on private property, the ones that have been cut down so far, and they're being taken down by Eversource, the electric utility for the Cape. Eversource officials say, listen, we have to take care of these trees. A lot of them were insect infested and were ready to come down, and they're old, and we really need to take care of them, because if they come down during a storm, and we saw a lot of these storms over the past several months, then people are going to lose their power. And we're in charge of making sure that power is reliable and continues to flow during those storms. They say these are on private property. They got the permission of the property owners. But anytime you're within one of these historic districts, people say, well, why didn't you have to go to the Old Kings Highway Historic District Committee, which is kind of the local committee that decides on things like paint and the exterior of homes to make sure it adheres to certain standards. The Old Kings Highway Historic District Committee, I think chairman who we spoke to said, yeah, I don't think trees are really in our jurisdiction on private property. That's really not what we're responsible for. He said it's a little bit of a gray area, but the DPW director in Barnstable said he didn't think that the committee had jurisdiction over trees either. There are a number of trees that Eversource is looking to take down in the right-of-way layout around the road, about 76. And for that, they will need approval from the committee. But these trees on private property, it wasn't something that the utility had to go to the committee for. A former town councilor there in Barnstable said she looked back and the Route 6 Tree Committee, which was active for about 6 years, 2009 to 2015, was exactly the kind of conduit for these types of conversations to take place ahead of time. And she says we should get that committee back up and running. So some folks upset out there, but it looks like Eversource kind of played by the rules. It's just that people don't like the outcome.
Patrick, I want to jump ahead here. The Outer Cape saw a training this week for responders who have specialized equipment to treat oil spills. It's part of a response network. I didn't know about this. It's a response network that runs up and down the state's coastline.
Yeah, this goes back quite a number of years to the 2004 Oil Spill Act. That was prompted by the 2003 spill of nearly 100,000 gallons of number 6 fuel oil into Buzzards Bay. People will remember the Bouchard barge that hit a shoal and spilled that oil into the bay, and that spread for 100 miles along the coastline. And the state looked at that and created this law that says we have to be more ready for this. And part of that was deploying these trailers that are filled with equipment and basically deploying them along the coast to the various towns along the coast. I think there are 70 coastal communities. And obviously, every community on the Cape is a coastal community. Truro was where this particular drill took place. Folks who work for the Department of Environmental Protection say there are about 6 or 7 of these communities every year that go through these drills. And they basically pull out the trailer, they pull out the equipment, which includes kind of these booms, these containment booms, and they figure out exactly how it's all going to work if there really was an oil spill along the coast. So there was a number of, I think, 3 different towns and folks from some various departments, the National Park Service, Coast Guard, Harbor Masters, et cetera, who were involved in this training on Wednesday at Truro at Pamon Harbor. And they went through the kind of the steps that they need to go through to make sure that everything's working right and they're all in communication together and it's all working as it's supposed to.
You have an article about an older neighborhood in Falmouth where there's concern about new houses replacing historic ones. It's an issue that probably resonates in many communities across the region.
Yeah, certainly. Cape Cod, obviously, you know, the tourism industry that started, about the turn of the century, a lot of these neighborhoods were created. This was an interesting neighborhood. It's Abbey's Lane in Falmouth, overlooking Megansett Bay. And it's got these, you know, really stately houses, Gothic Revival, Queen Anne, American Foursquare, and Shingle styles. None of which means anything to me, but our reporter, Christine Legere, has a good handle on these things. But it was an area where they had a lot of things going on. There was a casino at one point. There was all sorts of things going on when the tourism industry really started booming.
Talking about the 1920s, say, something like that.
Yeah, that area. And so then some of these houses have started to be torn down and replaced as people who own them. And there's one family in particular who owns about 8 out of the 24 houses on this small lane. Has been looking to demolish some of these houses and replace them with newer houses, and you can kind of understand that. But in the process, folks are worried that it's kind of this character of this neighborhood is being demolished as well. There is a demolition delay that's in place where it's about 6 months, but you can seek a waiver of that. And in at least 3 cases, that waiver has been granted. And some folks who are looking at the history here say there should be more kind of teeth and a better way to handle these situations. and make sure that, again, you're not taking away the character of a neighborhood like that as you're taking these houses down and replacing them. You basically the delay or they can't say that you can't take the house down. They can just say kind of what you can replace it with in a historic district like this. But they say the existing regulations don't have enough teeth. And you know, then you look at some of the houses and one in particular that's kind of really falling apart. And some people have wondered whether that was, you know, intentional at all, because if it's falling apart, it's kind of easier to say, hey, we have to tear this down. So a lot of questions and a lot of concern over kind of the changes in these types of neighborhoods.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Thank you, Patrick.
Thanks, Steve.
And our other contributors, we heard from Sarah Brown, the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, and Jim Kinsella from the Enterprise Newspapers. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.